You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 13th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everybody.
And our special guest, Richard Saunders.
Hello.
Welcome to the SGU.
Our first guest rogue.
Yeah, we are actually doing something a little bit new this year. Since we have so many friends in the skeptical movement that we've interviewed a number of times, rather than going through an interview format, we're just going to have some of our regular guests on occasionally as guest rogues. And Richard Saunders is the first one for 2010. So welcome again, Richard.
Thank you. I've been called a lot worse.
That's right.
But Steve, a guest rogue is actually someone that will do the entire show with us.
That's right. Yeah, that should have been obvious, but yes. Richard, you got the rules right. So you have to, at some point during the show, attempt a terrible accent, and you have to tell an extremely corny joke, at least one.
It shouldn't be a problem.
All right, good.
And you got to, don't forget, you got to geek out about something.
All right, I'll try.
Star Trek is usually the best topic.
Yeah, but don't
Star
embarrass
Trek.
It.
Oh,
but don't
okay.
embarrass
well,
us.
Do my best. Doctor Who, Star Trek, anything like that?
Yeah,
those are both okay. Perfectly fine.
Right. Cool.
So, Evan, what's the special day today?
On this date in history, January 13th, back in 1404, English alchemists were forbidden to use their knowledge to create precious metals.
Good thing.
So, yeah. So it was called the Act of Multipliers, and it was passed by the Parliament during the reign of Henry IV, mm-hmm. declaring the use of transmutation to multiply gold and silver to be a felony.
Did they also outlaw witchcraft?
It doesn't say.
Invisibility and teleportation are also right out.
Are right out.
Yes. None of that.
So that's why we don't have them today. I get it. Yeah.
But the law was repealed in 1689, when I guess they finally figured out after 285 years of insanity that perhaps maybe there's nothing to alchemy. So
right, well, it's a harmless law anyway, if completely worthless. Richard, before we go on to some news items, while we got you, let's update everybody on TAM Australia.
Yeah, really exciting. We've got a bunch of people over in this country working very hard and hand in hand with the James Randi Educational Foundation. It's going to be held downtown here in Sydney on the 26th to the 28th of November this year. And by a weird, strange coincidence, who knows why, the last day of TAM, which will be the 28th of November, will be my 45th birthday. So don't tell anybody, but that should be a lot of fun.
Excellent.
No, it's really exciting. Of course, headlining will be SGU, the whole gang, which is incredible for us. And people all around the country are very excited. I mean, we've got people flying in from Tasmania, New Zealand, all over the place, just because you guys are coming here. That's very exciting. Whee! We've got Brian Dunning from Skeptoid coming along.
Brian.
Skeptoid.
Very cool.
.com. Very cool. Our favorite geo, George Rubb, is coming along.
All right. Excellent choice.
Nice.
And lots of other names on the, well, let's see, the wish list or who will we invite next. But it's still a long time away, so we're sort of gathering together names and lists and possibly events and talks and things like that. A three-day event, as I said, downtown Sydney. There'll be lots of accommodation right nearby. November, late November is a beautiful time in Sydney. If you don't want to attend all the sessions or you got something else to do or you come early, head to the beach. Wonderful beaches in Sydney, sightseeing. It's just going to be a real blast. And Randy himself and DJ Grothy are coming along too.
Well, we are definitely looking forward to it.
Just found out by talking with a colleague this week that it takes a long time to get from the bottom of the country to the top. I didn't realize how big it was, you know.
Imagine, you think of Australia as roughly the same size as the United States minus an average state.
Mm-hmm. So it's huge.
So if you want to go from one side of the country to the other, you're going to... It takes days and days and days, and it's largely driving across desert.
Now, you do drive through the middle, though?
You can if you want to. I wouldn't do it. I'd rather fly.
Over it.
I've heard more than once, though, it's dangerous. Like, there's actually brigands out there and stuff.
There's UFOs.
UFO brigands, those are the worst.
They are the worst. No, there's old stories of people going across the Nullarbor Plain and all the deserts out there of strange lights in the night attacking their car and doing things to the dog and all sorts of things.
Well, that happens in the South.
Maybe it's worth it. Does it? I see.
There's still criminals left over from the Botany Bay.
Oh, God.
Botany Bay.
Ah, no. Now, here we go. That's the first Star Trek reference. Okay, well done.
You got that one.
He's keeping a log.
The captain's log. Thank you. Next.
Let's go on to some news items. The first one is the oldest tetrapod tracks have been discovered. Very cool. Back in Poland, tracks were found that date to 395 million years ago that are clearly of a land-walking tetrapod. So this is interesting because that's about 10 million years older than our fossil evidence for the evolution of tetrapods from fish, which shifts around the timetable a little bit. So we actually are developing quite a thorough fossil record of the transition from bony fish to the fins, you know, slowly changing into appendages that are more adapted towards walking, whether that was walking on like the bottom of rivers or even perhaps even the bottom of the ocean shelf, you know, actually in the ocean as opposed to lakes, and then onto land. The most famous one, I think, probably is Tiktaalik. You guys all remember Tiktaalik?
Yeah.
Discovered a few years ago. So, and this was made famous because the paleontologists that found it actually went looking for it. They said, we should find something pretty much like Tiktaalik around this time and place. They looked for it, and they found it. Beautiful transitional fossil, very much a confirmation of evolutionary theory, of course, of common descent. So this doesn't really change much about the cladogram, you know, the picture of what evolved from what when, except it shifts those lines back further into the past. So, you know, when you have a few specimens or a couple of specimens, sometimes just one specimen of a species from hundreds of millions of years ago, chances are it's not the oldest representative of that species, right? So the oldest example we have of any species is almost guaranteed not to be the actual true age of that species. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. That makes absolutely perfect sense. And this is the old story. I mean, this is just the scientific methodology repeating itself here, where scientists expect to find a certain type of animal because it fits completely in with what they would expect with evolution. Richard Dawkins covers this very well in The Greatest Show on Earth, his latest book. I don't know if you've had the chance to read it, where he talks about a flower, an extraordinarily deep flower, and the moth needed, the tongue or the proboscis on the moth needed to get down into the nectar was predicted. It wasn't found, but it was simply predicted by evolution it must exist, and lo and behold, they found it. But it's absolutely typical. Scientists go out, they expect to find something, they can find it, and that it's not in the same age group as they might have expected is also absolutely typical. And
absolutely,
then again, we just adjust our thinking.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you're talking about stuff that happened about 400 million years ago and our dating was off by 10 million years is actually a pretty small percentage. And in fact, I'm sure this is not the final word on the timing of all of this. We're going to find still older examples of tetrapod or fishapods, you know, things turning from a fish into a tetrapod, that we'll be dickering with this for years as we find more and more specimens. But of course, the creationists have to, you know, use this. They pretty much use these kinds of paleontological discoveries to try to cast doubt and confusion on common descent and evolution in general. So Casey Luskin from the Discotoot, the Discovery Institute, wrote just a ridiculous article. His job is to basically take the hit by embarrassing himself by writing the stupidest things he could possibly imagine. So he tried to make it seem like this evidence, this fossil evidence, or these tracks, actually they're not fossils, blows Tiktaalik out of the water as a transitional species, trying to say that Tiktaalik now can't be a transitional species, which is absurd. And he makes the same intellectual mistakes that they always make, proving that they are not educable, right? That they do not alter the points that they make even when they're called on them, when they're corrected on their mistakes. It doesn't matter. They continue to make the same mistakes over and over again because their mission is doubt and confusion, not genuine scientific inquiry. So you guys know the mistake that he made in arguing that, you know, basically tetrapods are older than Tiktaalik, the sample of Tiktaalik that we have.
Yeah, he's saying it invalidates it by predating it, right?
Yeah.
And then there's no chance of overlap or anything like that.
Well, so there's actually two different mistakes in there. One is the assumption that the dating of Tiktaalik based upon that specimen is as old as it is, right? When in fact Tiktaalik could certainly be much older. There could be more old examples of it. The other
we could have just found a young, you know, a specimen that died at that time when there's.
Yeah,
there could have been I'm sure there were generations that lived millions of years afterwards. Obviously,
yeah. I mean, the average species survives for about 2 million years, you know, but some could be much longer than that, and that's for a very specific species. The other mistake is that is this linear thinking that creationists, this sort of their straw man of evolution, is that A turns into B turns into C turns
right,
into
D. Right, it's a ladder of evolution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that if the sequence doesn't make sense, and then there must be something wrong with evolutionary theory. But in fact, you know, evolution's a bush, not a ladder. So most of these species that we have, most of these fish turning into tetrapods are probably not on the direct line from fish to tetrapods. They're cousins, right? They're branches. We're filling in the morphological space between fish and tetrapods. That doesn't mean it's a literal sequence. And we've had this conversation on this show before, just like, you know, there are still fish today, even though there are human beings, doesn't mean that humans and fish don't share a common ancestor. And, you know, a common ancestor that might have looked a lot more like a fish than it does like a person.
Right. I'd expect so, yes.
Yeah, there's still bacteria and people, right? I mean, even though bacteria and humans share a common ancestor that was single-celled, you know? So lines can retain quote-unquote primitive traits for millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of years. And that doesn't mean that they cannot also be related to a common ancestor of other groups that then evolved in different directions. So that's the, you know, when I wrote about this, I said that's basically the same mistake as saying if humans evolved from apes, why are there still apes? It's the exact same intellectual fallacy.
Yep. Or as I heard somebody say the other day, if the American country derived from the British colonial system, empire... Well, how come they're still a Britain? How come they're still in England? The same sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Because of branching, you know.
He also doesn't seem to get the idea that when we find new specimens like this, that it improves our accuracy. You know, it's a work in progress, and we know that.
Yeah, again, their job is doubt and confusion, right? So whenever we find new data that alters the details of the picture that we draw of what evolved into what when, they confuse the changes over the details as if it casts doubt on the bigger picture, common descent, that stuff evolved from stuff, when in fact it doesn't. But again, that's a game they've been playing for decades.
Is that the same sort of thinking that's like if one brick in the wall is faulty, then the whole wall must fall down?
Yeah, exactly. They're
one thread from a tapestry. You pull the one thread and it's not going to have much of an effect.
And then upon a little closer inspection, it's not even faulty.
Right, But, you know, it's like anything. It's like saying, well, we're refining our notions about how genes work. That means DNA is not the molecule of inheritance.
Yeah.
No, the basic concept is still correct. It's just we're getting deeper and deeper, more detailed information about it. But
I like the way you put it. It's his job. That's his job. What choice does he have? He doesn't. Mm-hmm. He can either do that or get out and get himself another job. That's his purpose in life.
Yeah, I think we figured out that he could get a job at Denny's. Pancakes and eggs and stuff.
Evan, you're going to tell us about the science of airport security.
Yes, in less than 5 minutes, I will sum up a very simple topic. No, actually, it's actually quite complex, and there's a lot to it and a lot of factors, and, of course, it's all over the news these days.
And we love talking about scientific topics that have deep political implications.
The reason we're tackling the topic this week is because there was a news story which made big headlines this week that claims, an AP story, mind-reading systems could change air security. And here's how it begins. A would-be terrorist tries to board a plane bent on mass murder. As he walks through a security checkpoint, fidgeting and glancing around, a network of high-tech machines analyzes his body language and reads his mind. Screeners pull him aside. Tragedy is averted. And as far-fetched as that sounds, the systems that aim to get inside the evildoer's head are among the proposals being floated by security experts thinking beyond X-ray machines and metal detectors.
Right, so of course it's not mind reading. It's inferring somebody's psychological state by their physical...
Yeah, body language.
Body language, yeah.
Right, and some biofeedback as well. You know, they're able to... Yeah. This technology is able to measure people's heart rates and body temperatures and so forth, and perspiration
from a distance, wirelessly.
From a distance, wirelessly, and supposedly without their knowledge that they are being viewed at some point. So it kind of goes, we've heard these sort of symptoms or claims before when it comes to, for example, polygraphs, lie detector tests, right? These are all biofeedback. It's kind of the same thing. However, in the case of those polygraphs, a person sitting down, at the table, has the wires and stuff strapped to him. He knows what the situation, what situation he's immediately in. Someone walking through an airport, though, not knowing where these sensors are or what exactly is that, is measuring these things, it becomes more of a blinded exercise, right?
So why does that make it more difficult? Because they have to kind of be on.
They're
going to be scared the whole time or nervous the whole time they're in the airport?
Yeah, you'd think so. And also they talk about, this is a specific company out of Israel, and they are the founders of WECU, WECU Technologies. And they've been around
for a Pandora?
Few years. Well, they're from Israel. Which is often looked upon as the global example of some of the best airline security on the planet. They point to Israel and the innovations that they've made. Well, this particular company is working and demonstrating their technology to governments all over the world, including the United States, and they believe that this is a way to, help prevent these sorts of terrorists from carrying explosive material into airports and airports.
But have they actually demonstrated this technology working, or is this just a marketing thing at this point?
Well, that's the thing, is they've done some testing on it, and with apparently decent enough results that they're ready to go to the next stage of implementing the next battery of tests. So nobody's really signed on to this technology.
Well, this is one of those technical topics where we felt we would benefit from some expert opinion. So we interviewed an expert on security about this and other related questions, and let's go to that interview now. Joining us now is Bruce Schneier. Bruce, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, thank you.
And Bruce is an internationally renowned security technologist and author described by The Economist as the security guru. And your first bestseller was Applied Cryptography, which sounds fascinating. And you agreed to come on The Skeptic's Guide tonight to talk to us briefly about some of the recent controversies in airport security surrounding a couple of things. Let's start with the notion of profiling, which I guess is probably the most controversial notion in airport security. So what's your take from a scientific point of view on the efficacy of profiling in anti-terrorism?
The profiling doesn't work. And, statisticians have written about this. Security experts have written about this. It's actually not controversial, even, among sort of people who know what they're talking about. The problem is that there isn't a perfect profile. And whenever you have a situation like that, and then you profile, you sort of pick a certain group of people to go through a harder security regimen than everybody else. Whenever you do that, you basically invite the bad guys to not meet the profile. And, if you think about even terrorism of the past 10 years, Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, was British with a Jamaican parent. You remember the dirty bomber was Hispanic. That was Jose Padilla. Now we have a Nigerian. One of the 7-7 bombers of the London transport system was Caribbean. I mean, there really isn't a profile. Mm-hmm. And by profiling, you basically sort of guarantee that the terrorists will go through security the easy way. And security is really much better when you randomly select people for secondary screening. Even if that means you screen a grandma occasionally, you're actually safer doing it that way.
So that there's a certain unpredictability about the randomness that is useful?
Right, and you don't want that to be exploited. And the problem is the terrorists can exploit that. For example, the Chechen terrorists that blew up two Russian planes several years ago, they were women because Russian security screened women less. So they were purposely picked for the mission so they wouldn't be secondarily screened. And, you know, this is a reasonable tactic by the terrorists. And also, if you sort of think about, you know, different ways you might want to profile based on, you know, buying a ticket in cash, based on, you know, not checking luggage, sort of all of these things, the terrorists can actually check this. So you can, at no cost to yourself, if you're a terrorist, just go on dry runs without actually doing anything, just trying to get an airplane and see if you're secondarily screened. And you do this enough, and you figure out what the criteria are. So even if they're secret, it doesn't help. And, you know, in the end, your security is worse because you're profiling. This is different from behavioral profiling. This is different from looking for people who look suspicious, which, if you do it right, I mean, the Israelis do it right, it's very effective. If you do it badly, it just devolves into racism. But done right, it can be very effective. And the TSA is also looking into that.
So that was one of the other topics I wanted to talk about, too. But quickly, so if it's, as you say, it's not even controversial among security experts, do you have an explanation for why the topic of profiling keeps coming up in the press?
Because a lot of people do want it. People who don't know better, the public, seems like it's a good idea. Lots of radio talk show hosts, lots of politicians. So you have this huge political push and pressure for things like profiling, and the TSA is going to be hard bent to say no. I mean, some of the things that have been talked about just aren't true. And if the underwear bomber bought a one-way ticket, that's not true. It's supposedly suspicious that he paid for tickets in cash. Well, Nigeria is a cash economy. Pretty much everyone pays for their ticket in cash. Mm-hmm. It's supposedly suspicious that he didn't have check luggage. You know, I travel 240,000 miles a year, and I pretty much never have any check luggage. So all of these things, which are sort of being built in the press, you know, turn out not to be at all, and actually are very common if you think about it.
Right. Yeah, interesting. So, do you subscribe to the notion that what's happening in airports now is so-called security theater to make it seem like we're doing something, but it's not really optimized for efficiency or effectiveness?
Yeah, it's 100% security theater. I mean, the two things that have been effective since 9/11 have been reinforcing the cockpit door and convincing passengers to have to fight back. And if you think about it, the second one of those worked on Christmas Day. And if you think about it even further, it was pre-9/11 security primarily that foiled this plot.
Mm-hmm.
Because we screen for obvious guns and bombs, it forced the bomber, or really the bomb maker, to build an inefficient bomb. Right? Instead of using a plunger or a timer or sort of any conventional detonation mechanism that a commercial PETN user might employ, he had to build this ad hoc thing with a syringe and 20 minutes in the bathroom. We don't even know what he did, but somebody set fire to his pants. Right? And it didn't explode. Right, that was pre-9/11 security that caused them to do that. And then after that, the passengers took over and pinned them and didn't let anything else happen. And that was post-9/11 security. So, right. You know, screening shoes, screening liquids, all that other stuff we do, complete waste of money. It didn't do an iota of good here. And yes, it's all security theater.
Do you have any stats or any idea on how many potential airline terrorists are being stopped by all of this security screening that's going on? Is it anything?
You know, my guess is it's zero. If you think about the Bush years, they would tout any random, dorky, little, nonsensical plot that they uncovered or found or arrested, and we haven't heard of anything coming from the no-fly list, coming from, you know, security screening. You know, it catches people who accidentally bring stuff on planes. It catches lone nutcases. You know, it catches people who are just common criminals. But no, near as I can tell, and I think we would know otherwise, it stopped absolutely zero terrorists.
Hmm.
And it's in some ways it makes sense because it's always fighting the last battle.
Yeah, yeah.
Against what the last person did. So we take away, you know, guns and bombs. The terrorists use box cutters. We take away box cutters and knitting needles, and they put explosives in their shoes. We screen shoes. They use liquids. We limit liquids. They put explosives in their underwear. We do full body scanning. They're going to do something else. Right? This is actually a stupid game, and we really should stop playing it.
So we're being reactive and not proactive. So what should we be doing then to be more proactive about this stuff?
So what we have to do is stop focusing on the tactic or the target. Now, there's a very deep psychological need to defend against what the story was. But the problem is the next story is going to be different. So what works is investigation and intelligence. You know, mm-hmm. Anything else we do that focuses on tactic or target is only effective if we happen to guess the tactic or target correctly. So think about the liquid bombers, right? They were arrested in London, and they chose liquids precisely because we weren't screened for it, right? So they picked a plot designed to get through airport security. Just like today's terrorists, we'll do the same thing. Pick a plot designed to get through airport security, even after full-body scanners. They were arrested in London in their apartments. But it didn't matter if they were using liquids or gases or powders. It didn't matter if they were targeting airports or shopping malls or crowded movie theaters. They were arrested. Right? That's smart security because it doesn't rely on guessing correctly.
Now, you mentioned that behavioral profiling is actually a good idea. Are you familiar with, that's been in the news recently, the so-called, I think it's the future attribute screening technology.
We see you.
Yeah, the We See You. It's like a lie detector type of technology that's being developed.
Yeah, I'm not impressed by any of those. The stuff that seems to work, and the Israelis do this, is basically, you know, interviewing. Now, what the Israelis do doesn't scale to the U.S. I mean, we can't possibly do it. But in Israel, everybody you meet when you go to the airport is trained as a security screener. So the airport employees, the actual security employees, the airline employees, everybody is trained. There are some pilot programs. You mentioned FACT. There are others that the TSA is implementing. And I think they show promise. It's kind of early to tell, but I'm optimistic about some of that stuff.
So if you were the security czar in our country, would you be pushing for developing more or better systems of behavioral profiling?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't, but this is why I'll never be security czar, because what I want to do is take all the money from airport security, right, return it to pre-9/11 levels, and take all the rest and put it in investigation and intelligence.
Interesting.
It's politically a non-starter. It'll never happen. Right, you know, the politicians have to react to the story. Although I was really, you know, pleasantly surprised when Obama made a speech and said, you know, we're going to try to fix the intelligence problems and don't worry too much about the technological details at airports. It was great. I was really surprised. But, you know, a lot of this stuff is security theater, and it's only effective if we guess correctly. And I'm tired of guessing. Because I'm going to guess wrong, by definition.
Well, Bruce, this was a fascinating interview. We really appreciate you giving us your time.
Now, thank you.
Very interesting interview. It's always nice to get the skinny from somebody who actually knows what they're talking about.
If this whole thing is worrying for you guys, you can always work your passage over here on a cruise ship or a cargo ship or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. How many weeks would that take?
Yeah, work it how?
4 to 6, something like that. Oh, painting the decks. I don't know. Cooking.
Yeah, but then we got pirates to worry about. Those Somali pirates are going to take us over.
Meet treasure.
Somali those Pacific Somali pirates. Yeah.
Those Pacific pirates, exactly.
They don't deserve the name pirate.
Oh, boy. Bob, is a supernova going to wipe out the Earth?
They are waterborne terrorists. good question. Did you guys check out the UK's Telegraph website? They had a great headline recently. Earth to be wiped out by supernova explosion. Now, wiped out was even in quotes, which obviously means that somebody, probably a scientist, actually said those exact words. Now, you may sense a lack of concern about this in my voice, and it's for good reason. So for some context, at the recent 215th meeting of the American Astronomical Society in D.C., Professor Edward Sion and his team from Villanova University in Philadelphia presented research into a double star system called T. Pixides. Is a double star system containing a white dwarf. The white dwarf is a stellar remnant from a medium sun-sized star about as big as the Earth. In situations where the white dwarfs are in a double star system, many times you'll have the white dwarf kind of just sucking in the hydrogen from the other star as they orbit each other. This hydrogen then kind of collapses onto the white dwarf, and it gets compressed really, really really an incredible amount, so much that it can fuse together and explode, creating essentially a gargantuan thermonuclear or H-bomb explosion, or a nova. I'm sure you've heard of stars going nova. That's essentially one type of nova. Now, this is purely a surface phenomenon, though, which means that the dwarf lives on to repeat the performance, and it does. Some white dwarfs do this over and over, and in fact, the white dwarf in this star system has been novaing every 20 years or so, from 1890 to 1967, pretty much like clockwork. Every 20 years or so, bam, this thing pops. But it stopped in 1967. Nobody really knows why yet. Another thing that we don't know is if there's any net gain after it blows. If you could imagine this white dwarf accreting the matter, this white dwarf will be slowly accumulating matter over time, getting more and more and more massive, mm-hmm. until it would reach a point where the neutrons, protons, and electrons are packed as tightly as nature allows. When this is approached, the dwarf can actually graduate to a supernova, or otherwise known as a type 1A supernova. Actually, you know, I did not know this, but this type of supernova is actually spews out more high-energy particles than the type 2 supernova, which is what you generally think of as a supernova, a supermassive star that collapses into a neutron star or a black hole, and the resulting explosion. Actually, this is more, in some ways, more energetic, more powerful mm-hmm. than that, which that was a bit of a surprise. I just assumed the more massive stars put on a bigger show. Now, the explosion, the equivalent, this is obviously a pretty big explosion. Every website I went to had the same 20 billion, billion, billion megatons of TNT. This is obviously a lot. Now, everybody seems to express these big numbers in multiples, like billion, billion, a million, million. Just it's 20 octillion megatons. I think it just sounds so much cooler. All right, so that's all just kind of like background. But now, what did these guys discover? They used these UV images that were recently taken, and they used cutting edge modeling that has never been tried before. And they claimed basically three discoveries based on putting these two together. One is that the star is not 6,000 light years from Earth, but a little over 3,200 light years from Earth. And they also presented the idea that the mass of this white dwarf is increasing, which would someday lead to this type 1A supernova. And then the last thing, that the most significant thing that they actually said was, and I'll read the last paragraph of their press release. It says that an interesting, if a bit scary, speculative sidelight is that if a type 1A supernova explosion occurs within that distance of Earth, then the gamma radiation emitted by the supernova would fry the Earth, dumping as much gamma radiation into our planet, equivalent to 1,000 solar flares simultaneously. Now, when I first read that, Steve, I think this occurred to you as well, but when I first read that, it just did not seem right to me, because 3,000 light years, okay, it's not 6,000 light years, it's a lot closer, but 3,000 light years is really, really far. That's really far away. I did not think that a supernova would have any impact over something like 3,000 light years.
No.
And in fact, that's exactly what other astronomers said at the meeting to these guys. Like, hey, wait a second, something's not right there. So, but it turned out that the team at Villanova made a mistake. They used the gamma radiation from a gamma ray burst and not from a 1A supernova.
Now, those guys are idiots.
Well, but now a gamma ray burst, do you remember that this is radiation, gamma radiation emitted from a very rare type of collapse of some types of stars. Huge. Basically, it's a gamma ray laser beam emitted from the poles of a star that's actually probably the most energetic, powerful explosions, at least concentrated energy in the universe that we know of. It's amazing the range that these gamma ray bursts have. Now, if this thing was a gamma ray burster, then he would actually be right. We would be in trouble.
Aimed at us, you have to add.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well,
beam,
obviously.
It's not everywhere.
To be.
Right. Yeah. So they use the gamma ray radiation energy numbers for a gamma ray
right.
burst aimed at the Earth, as opposed to a type 1A supernova, which would have to be within something like, what, 50 light years to be a risk to us?
Yeah, I thought that laser beam, though, was gigantic. Yeah.
It is, Jay. I remember, if I remember correctly, it's like a light year wide, which is quite a wide beam. But when you consider that this came from a star, you know, potentially thousands of light years away, that's still a pretty damn, you know, coherent beam we're talking about. But Steve, yeah, you're right. For a regular supernova or 1A supernova, 25. I've come across different numbers, but 25 to 50 light years. That's when you start getting concerned. So 3,000 light years. Sorry, there's really that's going to make a pretty picture in the sky. And we've got nothing to worry about. Now, I agree with Phil Plait. Phil blogged on this. He wrote a good blog on this. I agree with him. Scientists make mistakes, Jay. It happens. They're human. But if you're going to announce it to the world that the Earth is going to get fried, you better triple check your facts, because they know. You know how the science news cycle is. You know that they were going to run with this. When a scientist says the Earth is going to get fried, come on, you really got to vet it, because people were killing themselves over the black holes swallowing the Earth because of the LHC, you know? So people go kind of nuts over this kind of stuff. So you better get your science right and double check it.
This is definitely the worst science media fail of the decade so far.
Wow.
I would like to think that there's some science writer at these outlets would say, wait a second, and they would look a little deeper into it. But when the scientists are saying something, you can't really blame a lot of these outlets for just running with it. But you know what really disappointed me? I found an article about this on astronomy's website, astronomy.com. And it was one of the best articles I read. It had great detail. And then in the last paragraph, they said that, oh, and this, by the way, this thing could fry the Earth whenever it goes off. And so this is like a week ago this came out, and they still haven't updated their site. So now who knows who's reading this stuff, and they're believing it, and it's not even corrected. And it'll stay there. It could stay there forever for all I know.
They should really fix that.
Absolutely.
Science media fail. We have to keep track of these. Usually a few like this a year, like real just scientists really screwing up. Richard, you're going to give us some news from Australia about Mary, is that McAllops?
McKillops?
Lollipops? Is that like
singular,
lollipops?
Singular, lollipop. Talk about, and I'll get to media fail in this country as part of this report. Now, what's big time? What's really making the news here? Well, it was until this morning or last night when we heard the dreadful news from Haiti.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. Which has sort of put everything aside for the moment. However.
Yeah, well, just to say there was a massive earthquake in Haiti that's killed a lot of people and destroyed a lot of the city.
There are all sorts of numbers being flown around at the moment.
Yeah. It's so early to tell right now, I mean, but it's cataclysmic.
However, some background. Okay, the big story here in Australia at the moment is that we look like this year, sometime during this year, Australia will get its first saint, first Catholic saint. Her name is or was Mary McKillop, who was from 1842 to 1909. That was her lifespan. She was born in Melbourne. As a nun, she helped found the Sisters of St. Joseph of the Sacred Heart. Now, she helped set up women's refuge, an orphanage, homes for elderly women, all sorts of things like that. Now, by all accounts, she was a completely decent, caring, worthwhile individual and totally praiseworthy, doing things for the poor in our society. Wonderful person, regardless of her religious beliefs. It just doesn't matter. She was a good and decent woman.
Unlike, say, Mother Teresa.
Exactly. And there are more stories about that. That's true.
See Christopher Hitchens. Christopher Hitchens. Missionary position.
Yeah. More information. Now, that's great. And if she was just a notable person in our history, that would be well and good and worthy of attention and praise and possibly a statue. Who knows? She did lots of good things. However, in 1925, the process was started to make Mary a saint.
Do you know, has she been beatified yet?
Yes, she has. Yes, she has. She was beatified, let me see, around about 1992 or 3.
Mm-hmm. So that's the first step on the way to saint.
That's the first step. And
I thought it was beatify.
Beatified?
Oh. So Richard, there's lots of paperwork then. If it started in 1925, is that it?
There would have been lots of paperwork going back and forth to the Vatican, I'm sure. However,
so what do they do? Do they say, like, hey, remember that broad? She was hot. Sorry. Couldn't help myself.
Well, they are Italian.
Let me just regain
it's
my
skeptic's
composure.
Guy, man.
Hey. Steve, let me pick it up.
Go ahead.
Good luck.
Without giggling, good luck. Okay, so it was 1992 that it was considered that prayers to Mary were responsible for the recovery of a woman way back in 1961. So that was the first step for her sainthood. So she was beatified, I think, around about 1992 or 1993. All right, so it was prayers to Mary, and Mary obviously had a word to God, and so this woman who was apparently dying in 1961 recovered and was still alive around about 1990, 1995.
Because that never happened spontaneously.
It's just amazing. But however, that's great, but one more miracle is needed, of course, to complete the process to on your way to being a saint.
I mean, three total, right?
Two attributed to her. Probably thousands unattributed or will be attributed, but at the moment there are two. So in December last year, the Congregation of Causes of Saints issued a papal decree recognizing a second miracle. And this brings us to today's headlines, and I grab Sydney's Daily Telegraph from January the 12th, 2010, full page, front page, huge writing, "Just an Ordinary Miracle, How Prayer Cured Killer Cancer." With a tiny picture of Mary MacKillop tightly pinned to her chest, just in the way it was soon after she was diagnosed with inoperable cancer, an ordinary grandmother came forward yesterday to tell her not-so-ordinary story. Kathleen Evans' miraculous survival means Australia will get its first saint. And the story is covered on a double-page spread within the newspaper, and the big headline, "The Living Proof of the Power of Prayer." And all the articles in it basically saying what a marvelous thing it is. We've got our first saint. Prayer saved the woman. Prayer saved the woman. Talk about media fail. Reports are now coming in as far away as from Germany and Canada that prayers to Mary MacKillop have saved people. So this woman who has come forward and has become the star of the media is a 66-year-old lady who was diagnosed with inoperable lung cancer in 1993, which apparently had spread to the base of her brain. She was given only months to live. She prayed to Mary. 10 months later, the test revealed that she was in complete remission, and today she is fine and healthy. That's the big story here in Australia at the moment. Of course, there's been lots of doubt cast upon this. We've got a professor, Matthew Peters, from the Concord Hospital here in Sydney, who's a lung cancer expert, saying the chances of survival in such a case, such a diagnosis, is practically nil. He's cast doubt now on the original diagnosis. The one that really tickled me was the Anglican Archbishop of North Sydney has publicly questioned the evidence of this miracle. Now, is this a case of sour grapes or what? Here's a bishop from the Anglican Church saying, well, it's a Catholic thing, so it can't be real. I mean, this is a bit crazy to me. And he's saying, so she only prayed to Mary MacKillop. Maybe she prayed to God, too. Maybe it was God who did it all the time.
It's a little bleed over, yeah.
Yeah. The response from the skeptics, Australian skeptics, have issued our own statement on this because we were getting questions, which has been reported yesterday, I think, in a local newspaper near where this woman lives. The young Australian skeptics have blogged about this issue. It's amazing how uncritically, though, generally speaking, the media has been, because it's just perceived as a wonderful good news story. Prayer works. And apart from that, we're going to get our first saint, and Australians love to think that they can get world attention.
Well, anytime you could put the word miracle in a headline, that's a media win, right? I mean, that's one of, I think, the words that they most want to, you know, have in a headline. So it doesn't surprise me.
Well, the word miracle these days is used so casually.
Yeah, yeah.
Another good one, Steve, is earth fried. That's another good one to put in a headline.
Earth fried. It's a miracle. Earth has been fried. some commentators, however, Peter Cochran, writing in the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper online, is stating that, from his opinion, the Catholic Church is working hard to bring us back to the Dark Ages, more or less, and that they should put their money into cancer research. But it's a tough one, because this woman who's been apparently saved by this miracle is just a completely charming grandmother-type figure who's just really humble and...
probably very sincere, yeah.
Exactly, very sincere. So it's a very tough position for skeptics to be in a way, and I expect to get more comments about this, because it's hard to come out of this just seeming like you're interested in the truth rather than trying to pee on someone's parade, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the most challenging cases. You're dealing with someone's personal history of dealing with an illness.
Apparently, as far as I can tell, it would be the case that this woman probably had something wrong with her and got better. Unfortunately, we're not privy to, at this stage anyway, to her medical records. And it's amazing that so many people just won't think some obvious questions like this whole idea of praying to a saint. And the saint, on your behalf, will have a word to God. What's the saint going to do? Change God's mind?
Well, it's not like God's everywhere. You know, he needs saints to do.
Or that he knows everything. Yeah, there's serious logical problems with the whole notion of changing reality by praying to a deity. Yeah,
yeah, and of course, thousands of people for I don't know the best part of last century were certainly praying to Mary MacKillop for one reason or another, and if we have two examples of where she's come through. That's a really low hit rate, and somebody was saying if she was a doctor, she'd be struck off.
Right. Yeah, that's true. It's just you have no idea how many misses there are out there. Could be millions, you know.
It could be millions.
Yeah.
But how, from your point of view, Steve, how often are these type of very serious diseases like cancer of the lung spreading to the brain? And we're talking about 1992, I think, when it was diagnosed. What are the options here for misdiagnosis or spontaneous recovery?
Oh, the misdiagnosis is really easy. I mean, you have to ask, how was the diagnosis established? Was it
biopsy or imaging?
Was it just imaging? Was there a biopsy? You know, nothing is 100%. You would think that a biopsy is very specific, but you know what? There's an art to the biopsy reading as well. It's not absolutely ironclad. So that an error might have been made right at that point itself. Was she treated? I mean, was she given chemotherapy, even though they didn't think it was going to cure her? While the percentage is small, these kind of things, because of large numbers, happen on a regular basis, right?
Yeah. But a lot of those questions are unanswered at the moment. We hope they will be answered. But Regardless, it really does look likely that sometime this year she will be declared a saint and then, But hey, they're the Catholic Church. They're their own club. They're their own business. If they want to declare somebody a saint, they can do it if they like. I mean, I can declare somebody a saint. Saint Jay, maybe. That sounds good.
I appreciate
what's,
that.
What's the skeptical saint equivalent Jay. Of a saint?
Let's see. Knight takes rook. Queen.
Kick-ass mofo.
Well, now, Evan, we're going to do Who's That Noisy?
Here's the reveal for last week's Who's That Noisy?
And in a moment, we're going to apply a light to the top, and you should see some light forming. Okay, thank you. Just in case you missed that one, we'll try a slightly bigger one. If you have the lights down, please.
All right, so we asked the listeners to identify the noises that were being made, those whooshing noises. They have to figure out what that was, not the person who was talking. He was largely irrelevant. And people were able to guess. But the first person to guess on the message boards, Dolomedes, guessed that it was gas being ignited in a tube, with the explosion accelerating as it burns towards the end of the tube, which is exactly right. Now, I could have been, you know, a stickler and asked him what kind of gas is, but I figured that might be a little too difficult to tell from the noises. So,
what were the gases?
The gases were, in fact, nitric oxide mixed with carbon disulfide.
Mm-hmm. And is that the quote-unquote barking dog experiment?
Exactly, the barking dog experiment.
Well, I got it wrong. I thought it was a quick flushing electric toilet.
That is kind of what it's like. Those dry toilets, is that what they call it?
There's gas involved anyway.
Oh, that would have explained the laughter.
That was Dr. Peter Wolders from University of Cambridge Department of Chemistry giving a lecture and a presentation online about that. And that Who's That Noisy was sent in to us by Mark Hudson from Cambridge, England. So thank you, Mark, for sending that in.
What do you got for this week?
Well, this week we've got something, and it is somebody saying some very interesting things. Here he is.
It is vitally important that we as Christians be able to understand and interact with a modern scientific view of the world, or otherwise we're going to be simply culturally irrelevant in the 21st century of Western society.
That was P.Z. Myers in one of his famous stand-up routines.
That would be a famous stand-up routine, wouldn't it?
That's a good one, Evan.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Give your guess, message board. You can email it to us however you want. Send in your guess, and good luck, everyone.
Next, we're going to do a couple of questions. First question comes from Chris Aitken from New Zealand. And Chris writes, just one more fan reporting in from New Zealand. Anyway, a hypothetical question for the Rogues. If each of you were to give up your morals, that assumes we have some, and decided to make a living off of pseudoscience, what would you choose and why? All the best and keep up the great work. Now, Evan, you've already had your fantasy about what you would do if you had no morals. Would you like to tell us about it?
Well, you know, okay, I will tell you about it. However, Steve, do we run the risk of, by divulging this information, that, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that our listeners are amoral or anything, but, you know.
You don't want to give them any ideas?
Well, there might be one or two people from, say, Discovery Institute or something that listens, and, you know, to pick up information on things you're saying, and they might get some
Well, we'll have to trademark all of the ideas that we're saying right now so that nobody else can use them.
That's good. So this is a patent-pending, trademark, copywritten, and registered idea by Evan Bernstein of The Skeptic's Guide. All right. So the product is called Homeopops, right?
Homeopops.
Homeopops. What could that possibly be? Well, it's simple. You take your favorite homeopathic remedy, and we will put it into your favorite flavored popsicle. Mm-hmm. Fun for the whole family, grandma, the kids, the dogs. I mean, anybody can eat these. You can have medicine all summer long, cool and refreshing, delicious tasting. You don't even know that you're getting medicine.
Oh, and you think this is an original idea?
I mean,
you can buy those here in the pharmacies in Australia.
Are you kidding?
No, homeopathic popsicles.
Lollipops.
Oh no, these are ice. You know. Ice pops.
Well, okay, yeah, we're splitting hairs. It's and the packaging's got this kid who looks really sick, and the mum's giving him a lollipop, you know, for his fever. But it's homeopathic. Oh, it makes me sick.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, that's nothing. See, when you start getting down to treating the children with with bogus remedies and so forth, I think you reach a certain low that is, you know, the lowest snake crawling.
Not
on its
the
belly,
children.
Won't somebody think of the children?
So, Richard, what would you do? Put your evil genius to work.
Yeah, you know what? I think, and I've only just been getting into this relatively recently. You know, kinesiology. Or applied kinesiology, and this is largely muscle testing and things. You might have seen there are a couple of companies out there, one called Fusion XL and one called Power Balance, where you go along to their stand. They're usually in psychic fairs or mind fairs or whatever it is. And they'll test your strength and balance by pulling down on your outstretched arm, and you'll tip over. Then they'll give you the magic device which you hold, and lo and behold, your balance and your strength and your flexibility magically increase. In fact, I was on TV a few weeks ago here in Australia testing this whole thing, and discovered that the device that was being peddled, which was a hologram, completely failed the tests. Nevertheless, I've learned now how to do these tests very well, and I've actually convinced people that I've got the magic power, or if I give them a pendant, they have the magic power. So I think if I were to sell myself down the river, and for the right money, who knows? That's probably something I do, because I've discovered in doing it for demonstration purposes, people buy it. It really does seem to work.
So, and how are you going to parlay that into millions of dollars?
Well, one of the things I could do in this country is publicize myself, or have myself publicized by whatever company I hooked up with, as Richard Saunders, the well-known TV skeptic who endorses our product.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
All the other things Richard Saunders has completely dismissed, but our product, and he can actually demonstrate it. I think I'd get some mileage out of that, and I could probably get a nice paycheck. Fear not, listeners, I'm not about to do that.
Yes, again, based on the premise of the emailer that we have morals.
Hmm.
And I like how you qualified that. Not about to do that.
I'm not about to.
That could mean anything. Very clever.
Oh, if people want to see that video of me actually testing this thing, if they go to skeptics.com.au and click the publications link, they'll see a link to videos and they can watch it there.
What do you got, Jay?
First of all, like, we've been doing this for years now. We've been coming up with these businesses for years, right?
As thought experiments, of course.
Yeah. I came up with one a long time ago that I actually almost implemented and didn't pull the trigger for the exact fact that my morals kicked in and I couldn't do it. And I think that that idea would actually have made me very rich. But the one I will talk about, because I'm actually not going to reveal the other one because it's too good. The one I will talk about is my favorite. That we came up with is Steve's evaporative therapy. Mm-hmm. I love that. All you do is you take
Dr. Steve's.
Dr. Steve. You take rubbing alcohol, or you know, make it like one of those hand sanitizer things. Put a little food coloring in it so it has a little color. Put a little, you know, put a little scent on it, and then basically the whole idea is you put it, you know, rub it on somebody's stomach or a place where they're having a pain, and the evaporation will draw out the toxins or whatever.
Your basic detoxifying scam.
But the thing that
combined with aromatherapy,
yeah,
you would enjoy. You would enjoy rubbing it into people, wouldn't you?
Right.
That's half second. The therapy.
Wait, Dr. Steve, all the other ones are scams. This one is right. The real one that works. You didn't read the script, so
right. I'll give
you. The one that I would probably become a
cult leader.
Yeah, I would want to. I would become a cult leader.
Definitely. That was mine, Jay. You stole mine.
Recently, this guy, one of these preachers, like basically said, "I need money," and he got $20 million.
Really?
Like within a week? Yeah, within a week. Wow. $20 million.
I need
bucks.
Money. I need.
Yep.
Didn't,
yeah, come on. That's it. I mean, we guys, we really made big, big moral.
When
mistakes.
We say we need money, we get $20.
We get $20.
I accept U.S. currency. I really do. So you know, it's fine.
I need women.
Yeah. Well, Bob, here's the thing: you become a cult leader, you get both. Because the first rule of the cult is you have to give me all of your money. The second rule of the cult is that I have access to all the women. That's every cult's first and second rule.
I thought it was first you get the money, then you get the power, then you get the money.
Doesn't matter. Does it matter? I don't think so.
Yeah, well, once you get people believing, you know, the end game type stuff, like once you engage their sense of religion, their sense of spirituality, and you know, making them promises that give them things to hope on. I mean, that's,
well, yeah, like we,
that's
we've,
powerful.
We've talked about the nature of cults, like the 20 features of a cult. That's basically a how-to manual. You could, right? It also, you could flip it around. It's not how to recognize a cult. It's how to create one.
Yeah, but I don't know of anyone who's actually done it from the skeptic side of the fence. I know there are a lot of con people out there.
How about Ayn Rand? Rationalist cult.
Yeah. Hmm.
Interesting.
She was really kooky.
Bob, you got something different for us?
Yeah. Yeah, that, I mean, that all sounds like too much work, all that stuff. You know, I would make it efficient, in and out, bam, bam, and then enjoy myself. So I would cash in on the power of pareidolia. Uh-huh. I would manufacture and sell one-of-a-kind holy artifacts like the face of Jesus, like the face of Jesus on a taco for $1 million on eBay. Crank out 5 or 10 of those. I'd be good.
And then
I'm
you're
done.
In Tahiti, and you're done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thanks for the fun question, Chris. We're going to do a quick name that logical fallacy. I'm going to read the paragraph, and then you guys tell me who you think wrote this. The current healthcare debate has brought up basic questions about how medicine should work. On the one hand, we have the medical establishment with its enormous cadre of MDs, medical schools, big pharma, and incredibly expensive hospital care. On the other, we have the semi-condoned field of alternative medicine that attracts millions of patients a year and embraces literally thousands of treatment modalities not taught in medical school.
Jenny McCarthy.
Nope.
Yeah, too cogent for her.
Good question.
I would say Oprah, but I don't think she would use the word modalities.
Right.
So I'm going to go with Deepak Chopra.
Deepak Chopra is correct.
Well done.
He had some co-authors. Co-authors were Rustam Roy.
of homeopathy fame.
And Dr. Dossie. And guess where it was written?
In the bathroom.
Time magazine, probably.
No, The Huffington Post.
The Huffington Post.
Let's say. course. Repository of...
I mean, the whole thing, and the title of this was basically an attack on science-based medicine. Mm-hmm. I take great pride in the fact that they used my term.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yes, they used my term, science-based medicine, which I coined. I think there's a certain threshold you cross when your ideological enemies are using your terminology to refer
That's awesome.
Well,
the enemy, right?
Nice.
And David Gorski does a good job on science-based medicine of ripping into shreds. But you could take any one and just have a logical fallacy fest, and this is just one of them. So what do you guys think about what logical fallacies can you perceive in here?
I mean, it's a false premise. I mean, surely the beginning statement, the current health care debate has brought in a basic question. Has it? I mean, in some people's mind, I'm sure it has. But then we move on to what I can only see as a false balance. Trying to compare one system with the other.
False dichotomy.
False dichotomy.
It's both false balance and false dichotomy. And the entire alternative medicine campaign is based upon this false dichotomy.
Hmm.
Right? This notion that there's two kinds of medicine, you know. And then they have to create the false dichotomy, of course, then try to establish themselves as the false equivalents.
Yes, yes.
As a legitimate alternative, right? Quite a few straw men in there. Provocative language to evoke a very sinister image of a conspiracy or a big megalithic organization.
And the use of the term semi-condoned.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I think that's a twofer. Because they're trying to say that it's popular, so there's an argument ad populi, but at the same time, they're the underdog. They want to be perceived as the underdog, which again sort of casts a sinister sort of eye on established medicine. This wasn't the worst of it by far. You know, it's a good article. If you go to the Science Based Medicine, you could find the link to this article. And for those budding skeptics who wanted to test their logical fallacy detecting skills, go through that article and count them up, man. It's as good as any creationist article, which is saying something.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my international panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready?
Yes. Let's do it.
All right, here we go. Number one. Scientists discover the first clear evidence for the use of cosmetics by Neanderthals. Item number two, new research suggests that a significant percentage of forest fires are caused by sunlight magnified by droplets of water. And item number three, scientists have published the first application of a quantum computer calculating the energy of molecular hydrogen. And Richard, since you are our guest this week, you can go first.
Scientists discover the first clear evidence for the use of cosmetics by Neanderthal. Initially, I would say, no, they're too busy running around trying to eat mammoth and survive and whatever they had to do. But, I mean, they are a branch of human. It doesn't strike me as being that far-fetched. I find that quite interesting. I don't know how effective it would have been. I mean, sure.
Well, another Neanderthals,
yeah. Yeah. Hello, darling. You're looking nice tonight.
What was that?
That
was awesome.
Oh, they spoke... Awesome. Sorry. They spoke German. I got that wrong. Hello, mein Schatz. Du bist so schön heute Abend. Yeah, that's my German end. New research suggests that a significant percentage of forest fires are caused by sunlight magnified by water droplets. I'm going to have to rule that one out because, God, that'd be happening all the time. The world would be ablaze with forest fires if that was the case, I would think. Scientists have published the first application of a quantum computer calculating the energy of a molecular hydrogen, if I got that right. That one I'm not sure about. If I was to call it, I'd say that why not? Probably Neanderthal was so ugly they needed to look more beautiful. So I'll call that one science, and the other two I'll call fiction.
But there's only one fiction. You got to put your nickel down on one.
Oh, come on.
that's the game.
Come on, man.
Man, I'll go for... All right, number two is fiction.
I love this guy.
The water droplets causing forest fires.
Yeah, let me call that as fiction.
Okay, Jay,
go next. This is the way we play it in Australia anyway.
Oh, okay.
That's awesome. No, I am going to do exactly what Richard did. Double my chances of getting a wreck. All right, so scientists discover the first clear evidence for the use of cosmetics by Neanderthals. I agree with that. New research suggests that a significant percentage of forest fires are caused by sunlight magnified by droplets of water. Whoa! How can that be true? How can rain cause fire? Craziness. All right. Scientists have published the first application of a quantum computer calculating the energy of molecular hydrogen. Bob, what do you think about that?
We'll find out in a moment.
Man, that's really... I totally agree with Richard. One of those two is it. We don't have quantum computers.
So, are you calling it?
Steve. What is two for? Wait. No, he's saying, Steve, this has to mean when we have a quantum computer, we're going to calculate the energy of molecular hydrogen, correct?
That's not what the statement says. Have published. Past tense.
This is totally bullshit. So I'm going to go with the water droplet as the fake, because there's a total – something's going on with number three.
Okay, Bob.
Okay, for the first one, I'm going to buy the whole Neanderthal cosmetics. That makes sense to me. They were so advanced in the other areas. I mean, why couldn't they look pretty if they wanted to?
Not even if they wanted to.
That'd be funny if they find out that just the guys wore it. That'd be pretty funny. The forest fire and water, oh, man. I'm finding having a hard time imagining that's a significant percentage of forest fires. I can't imagine that eclipsing, you know, things like lightning and stupid people causing them. If there was droplets of water still on plants enough to magnify the light and cause it, you would think generally it would have probably rained, unless it was just dew, but it would have rained recently, and that would have inhibit or at least limit the damage.
Bob, why are you wasting your time? There's no way that number three is the fiction. There's no way.
Way three is a fiction?
Yes, because of the conundrum in there. It's number two, man.
I'm not seeing a conundrum there, Jay. I know what he's trying to say, and I think he's trying to get us to a knee jerk into the three. I think maybe they've got one or two qubits working okay, and they could determine the molecular the energy of the molecular hydrogen with very few qubits. But very few qubits don't really get you that much. So maybe it's a very, very weak quantum computer. You really can't do a hell of a lot. Crap. Yeah, it's really tough between two and three. But I hate to say this, but I'm going to go with Jay and say it's the forest fire droplets.
Very brave. Evan?
Very brave.
Well, okay, so Neanderthals and cosmetics. So
Neanderthal.
I see and hear it both ways now. It was Neanderthal,
really?
Then it was Neanderthal with a T, then they brought back the H. Who knows now what the hell it's supposed to be?
Well, originally it was, yeah, you're right, Neanderthal, because the H isn't pronounced in German. Anyway.
Right, but in America, we Americanized it to Neanderthal, and that's what everyone has in their head. But then it was corrected, and then they tried to correct the spelling so that people would know how to pronounce it, but that didn't work. So they said, screw that, went back to the T-H-A-L. And now I don't even know how people are supposed to pronounce it. But it's probably supposed to be Neanderthal. Yeah, from the Neander
New
Valley.
So the Neandies definitely used cosmetics. And I think what might have happened, here's what I think would happen. They made some kind of, you know, mashed up some berries and put it on their face. And I guess technically that's a cosmetic or something. Or maybe they tried to eat it and some got left on their lips. And technically that was use of cosmetics in some sense. But maybe it's something like that. But I think
how
it's
would we know about that in Neanderthal?
we read their books that they left. So I think that's plausible. And then the forest fires one. Well, I was thinking the same thing Bob was. Well, droplets of water, didn't it just rain? And, you know, how susceptible are forests that you know, just rained, unless it was really dry and they had a sudden burst of shower and, you know, couldn't, you know, dampen the ground enough to stop the forest fire. So possibly quantum computer, you know, I just know nothing. I know nothing about quantum computers. Well, hardly anything. Like Jay, I thought that they were a something that was still in development that's not been established yet, that they're working on it. But, you know, this droplets of water in the forest fires one is not sitting right with me. So I'm going that way. That's fiction.
All right. So you all agree that scientists have discovered the first clear evidence of use of cosmetics in Neanderthals.
Und
that one is science.
Yeah.
And that's actually pretty surprising. This is a paradigm change because this is the first evidence of any real, anything artistic among the Neanderthals, anything that would be considered a clear sign of symbolic thinking.
Didn't they paint rocks or caves or something?
No, that's all humans. Those were all Homo sapiens.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, it's all.
And they also then didn't bury their dead with decorations and stuff. That was
they did bury their dead, but
right. I thought they did.
That's not enough to conclude that it was.
So how'd they do it?
So what they discovered was scallop shells that have been painted. First, they found lumps of red and yellow pigments, the source of which was miles away from where they found the scallops, that indicated they probably were collecting them in the scallops and therefore were probably using them for body ornamentation. But they also found some that had holes made in them and that probably the shells themselves were worn as decoration and they had been colored. So that actually is fairly big news.
Did they say what the cosmetics were made of?
Yes, they did.
Can you imagine a Neanderthal Avon lady? Go away!
I think these crushed shells would look good on your eyes.
There was one pigment was lipidocrosite mixed with ground bits of hematite and pyrite.
Oh.
So that would have given it like a flashy reflective appearance, actually.
Ooh, very disco 70s.
Lots of bling, very blingy. All right, let's get on number two. New research suggests that a significant percentage of forest fires are caused by sunlight magnified by droplets of water. And this one, you all think this is the fiction.
Yeah.
And this one is the fiction.
Yeah! Oh, I nailed it this week.
Is that the second clean sweep in a row?
Maybe.
Maybe.
Now, in fact, though, this was until this was the first study really looking closely at what the effect of droplets of water on plants. And in fact, it was believed that it was a significant cause, or at least potentially, of maybe forest fires. And it's been conventional wisdom in a long time, like not to water your garden in the sun because you can get plant burn or leaf burn from the droplets of water magnifying the light.
Right.
In fact, remember, Bob, when Yao Man started a fire by putting a drop of water on his glasses.
Yeah.
And it was really the droplet that magnified the sunlight and
that was awesome.
Made the fire. But here's the thing. Here's what they found. They actually found that it doesn't cause fires, probably. And also, it probably doesn't also cause that much in the way of leaf burn. And here's why. The droplet, in order to focus the light and intensify it onto a plant.
It can't be on the plant.
It can't be directly on the plant.
It has to be hovering in the air.
It's got to be hovering over it. Now, that can happen. They found that there are some ferns and some kinds of plants that have leaves with little hairs on them, and they can suspend the droplet right at the perfect distance, and they can cause leaf burn that way. But the droplet would have to be just the perfect distance away from the leaf. The reason why it doesn't cause forest fires is because if it did have that magic arrangement of a droplet suspended the right distance from a dry leaf, let's say, it would evaporate pretty very quickly as part of that process. So it just wouldn't persist long enough to get it going and spark the forest fire. So they believe it's therefore very unlikely for that to happen. But not impossible. He said it's not as possible, just not very likely. Which means
yeah,
the one I thought I was going to get you guys on.
Yeah. You are almost.
Scientists have published the first application of a quantum computer calculating the energy of molecular hydrogen. Now, Bob, you had me worried because right before the show, you started asking me about the quantum computing.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm
like,
oh, damn, did Bob see this? Is that why he's asking me?
I saw another news item. I didn't see this one.
Quantum computer calculates exact energy of molecular hydrogen. This is published in Nature Chemistry, so part of the Nature Publishing Group, very prestigious. Partnership between a team at Harvard and a team at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
Yay, cool.
Yay. And,
good day to right. all the people in Brisbane.
So this is one of those problems. Calculating the energy of a molecule is one of those problems where as you scale it up, the computation time increases exponentially. So you very quickly exceed the computational power of all the computers in the world. This is the exact kind of problem that quantum computers are supposed to be good at. And they were able to actually build a small quantum computer that could deal with this specific problem of calculating the total energy of molecular hydrogen. And they did it and they published their paper.
How many qubits?
I don't know. They didn't say.
Oh, that's, well, the Bible says 400 qubits. But
I was waiting for that, yeah.
Great news, though. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's interesting news. I mean, there are some the nitty-gritty technical questions will be interesting to dig up.
But so I was right, Steve.
in what way?
I was right. I was right. My logic worked.
It worked. We'll say that.
Okay, there you
go. Yes, your logic worked.
Thank you, sir.
So congratulations, everyone.
Thank you.
Again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I did have a sort of – I hedged my bets a little bit, but I came up right at the end. Yeah.
You did when I forced you into a corner.
You didn't do what you were supposed to do. Whenever you're asked to go first, you've got to call Steve a bastard.
This is a strange new rule I'm not too sure about, but Steve, you are a complete and utter bastard for those questions.
Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I do have a quote. And Richard, I want you to say the guy's name. You think you could do it?
I don't know. I haven't seen it.
But you gotta yell it like I do. All right. This is a quote from Jose Blau. I could be pronouncing that wrong. And he is, or was, an American universalist clergyman and theological writer. I had to look up what universalist meant. Universalism refers to religious, theological, and philosophical concepts with universal meaning applying to all, application or applicability.
Right.
All right. So anyway, the quote is, "Weary the path that does not challenge. Doubt is an incentive to truth, and patient inquiry leadeth the way."
Jose Blau.
Good job, Richard.
Very good.
Wait, that was me imitating Richard's accent as if he would say it like I would say
it.
Yeah,
I didn't say that. That was Jay.
I should give props for that.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Oh, you had me. Good job, guys.
Thank you.
Jay, you got a couple announcements.
I have announcements. I do. First off, we didn't thank Ducky last week, but Ducky, basically he ran the boards for us for a long time, did all the heavy lifting, and we owe him a great deal of thanks and love for all the work he put in. Thanks, Ducky.
Gracias, Ducky.
Thanks, man.
I have another announcement. This one is for Caroline Gale. Caroline is one of the people that created Skeptics in the Arts, and they are a company of critically minded people that produce skeptically themed productions, and they're looking for submissions of one-act plays and directors who would like to get involved. The production is called Acts of No Faith. If you have something to submit or are interested in writing something new or are interested in directing, please contact Caroline Gale at actsofnofaith, no spaces, no nothing, actsofnofaith@gmail.com.
Groovy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we also forgot to name the winner of the contest. We asked our listeners to give us all of their feedback for the year-end wrap-up show, which was just a bunch, answering a bunch of questions about like their favorite quote or their favorite episode and whatnot. And we picked a winner from the boards. The winner is Quirk3K. And Steve, tell him what he's won.
Well, Jay, he's won a signed copy of the first issue of the New England Journal of Skepticism. But wait, there's more, because he's also won a fit-to-order SGU t-shirt.
And a set of steak knives.
A good t-shirt. Steak knives.
Well, Richard, it's been a blast having you on the Skeptic's Guide. I think this was a good idea, actually.
Thank you very
much.
What a great way to start 2010 or 2010 or whatever you want to say it. And, of course, if you can bear to listen to more of me and my friends, you can tune into the Skeptic Zone podcast at skepticzone.tv.
That's right, if you want to listen to Skepticism with an Australian accent.
Right, that's right.
Crikey!
Richard, you're awesome.
That was Richard who said that, by the way. No angry emails.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Good episode.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.